All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on the Land of Israel.com network. God bless you and shalom. So much missed being with you wherever you are out there over the Passover Pesach holiday. And we are back to broadcasting here. And, of course, we're also back to Torah. We never left Torah, and Torah never left us, but we haven't broadcasted as much as we could have, should have. In any case, no regrets. We move forward, and here we are in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in the heart of Jerusalem with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you again. I was looking forward. I mean, that was the one thing that I wanted to see the holiday ends, is just to get back to hanging out with you here.
That and bagels.
Pita. We don't do bagels as much here, although we do have some bagels. Some holy bagels. Literally, there's a restaurant in the old city called Holy Bagels. Is that what's called still now?
Or is Holy Bagel, yeah.
Yeah, it's still Holy Bagel, because there was another Bonkers Bagel for a while. It's a whole bagel. You know how it is about bagels. It's the circle of life. Any case, we are on Spiritual Cafe, and we have so much to talk about, Rabbi Mike, because we are in a super spiritual period. You know, I feel like I feel like I'm a, you know how like Karlbach and Hasidic books are always like, and this holiday is the most important holiday.
Yep.
Right? So it's like this is now the season. We are in the midst of an incredible season. Two things are happening at the same time this week. That is, if you didn't know, we started counting the Omer count. That's the 50-day count from the second day of Passover all the way until Shavuot, the holiday of receiving of the Torah. In English biblical ease, it's Pentecost, count 50. Okay, 50 days. So we're actually doing that. If you want to be a true Bible person, you do that. You count 50 days. That's what we're doing. We're counting them every single day. Today happens to be the 11th day, which is a week and 4 days of the Omer count. Last night I went to, and you'll hear it on the show today, I went to the tombs of Yoshua ben Nun, Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb ben Yefunneh, Caleb, and actually Joshua's father Nun, all buried in a beautiful Arab village right outside of Ariel called Timnath Cheres or Kifl Cheres. And it was an incredible thing. Why? Because on the 11th day of the Omer is the Yortzeit, the passing day of Joshua.
Oh.
Yeah, and it was awesome. It was so, so awesome. I'm so glad I did it. And so that's we're counting these 50 days, but within these 50 days are massive holidays, including the second Passover, that's what we call Pesach Sheni, Yom HaShoah, tonight and tomorrow, that's Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day, a very powerful day here in Israel, Israel Independence Day, Lag BaOmer, and Yom Yerushalayim, of course. That's right. And you and I are flying out to Los Angeles, California. I'm going to stop in Phoenix also on the way.
We're going on the road.
We're putting the show on the road.
That's
the show
right.
is going on the road. And we're going to be in Los Angeles, the City of Angels. Very excited about that. From one City of Angels to another. I'm very excited to be there as well. So that's a whole track of things. We could talk about every single one of those days as a full show. And then at the same time, we have one of the most central Torah portions in the Torah. Now, I wouldn't have the audacity to say this is a central Torah portion, if not that Rashi, the great commentator himself, says that the majority of Jewish law is based on this week's Torah portion. And not only is some of the stranger laws of Judaism, for example, don't be like the Gentiles, don't cut the side of your hair. And you may wonder, why do you see Orthodox Jews with those strange side locks? That's because the Torah portion tells us, don't cut the sides of your hair. Don't look like those priests of idolatry who cut out the sides of their hair, you know, like Friar Tuck and stuff. Don't be like that. But then there is also, and this is what I really wanted to talk to you about in the Torah portion of Kedoshim, Be Holy, chapter 19 of the book of Leviticus. The other aspect that I want to talk with you about is morality. There's a lot of really Jewish morality that's in this week's Torah portion.
You know, it's interesting you chose that word because I was going to argue with you, but I let you go in your flow that Rashi doesn't actually say that the laws are dependent upon this portion. What he says is, this is Melamed Sheneemar Parsha Zu Behakel, right? The opening words that Moshe is speaking to all the congregation of Israel comes to teach that this Parsha was actually said in a full assembly of the people. Mipnei Sherov Gufei Torah Tluyin Ba, that the majority of the bodies or the embodiments of the Torah, it's not the law, it's the way of being. And that's exactly what we mean by morality. This portion is the crux on which the Jewish way of being hangs. And that ultimately gets expressed and specified in law, but there's something more foundational.
Right, right. Okay, so I think you said it better. And I was just using it the topic of morality to distinguish from legal, the regular legal stuff. For example, just one example, it says recognize the gray-haired person, stand up for them. Don't stay seated. Lifnei vatakum. If you see a gray-haired person, rise up for them. And people may not know this. This biblical passage is actually, there's a sticker of that biblical passage within the buses of Israel. When you walk onto a bus, you see that little sticker that says Lifnei vatakum, which means get up in front of a gray-haired person and let them sit down, give them your seat.
Which people do. It's always amazing. I'm on the buses every day, and you know it's always a funny moment. Because the continuation of that verse says that, and you should fear the Lord your God. And Rashi points out, because, you know, only God knows whether you were ignoring and pretending not to see this old elderly person who wants to sit down. And I always have this inner analysis I have to do, because there's an age at which it's actually offensive to stand up and offer someone your seat because they don't want to feel old. And then there's an age at which it's offensive not to get up. It's like a very, there's a sensitization to the experience of the other, which is the background or the backbone, I would say, of the morality taught in Kiddushim. I need to be conscious of how my actions can either ennoble or degrade the people with whom I'm interacting.
Swearing in God's name falsely is a recurring theme here also, which is to speak in truth. Speak in truth, and that relates to what you just said, which is there's a truth. And God knows it, and you could easily hide it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was inspired recently by reading about some Hasidic masters who made truth their a central pillar in their life observance. I wouldn't say it's not even a religious observance. It's like a core value, and that they would always run away from lying. And oftentimes I see situations where people want to lie a little bit. And there's even some legal places where there's some places in the law that allows you to lie if you're making peace between people and stuff like that. But in any case, lying is something that could happen very easily in societies. But the Torah here goes out of its way to say, you know, do not steal, do not deny falsely, do not lie to one another. You shall not swear falsely by my name, thereby desecrating the name of your God, I am Hashem.
Listen, to me, this ties into your original statement about the foundations of the Torah hanging here, because truth is something which, once you know it, it demands action. Right? We've said many times that the Torah is not about theology. It's not about thoughts, man's thoughts on God. Right? They're God's thoughts on man as expressed in action. Because if it's true that the elderly deserve respect, if it's true that those who are ignorant should be taken care of and not deceived, etc., all the legal expressions here, then they demand, those things demand action. And that's one of the things that I find frustrating in the world in general, is that people espouse values. But when they come into situations of conflict where they don't want to offend others or they're afraid of other people's reactions, they swallow those values. And the great power of the Hasidic masters, that I'm familiar with many of the stories you're speaking about, is that they allowed their values to truly shape their lives. And that's my understanding as a teacher of Jewish law, of halakha, that the whole legal system is really about embodying values in action.
You shall not commit a perversion of justice. You shall not favor the poor. And you shall not honor the great. With righteousness shall you judge your fellow. I always think that this is one of the proofs that the Torah is written for Jews, because it first places, do not favor the poor. I think that in almost no other society do you have to watch out for that as much as with Jews. Meaning to say, if this book was written for other nations, it would have said, do not favor the rich. You know,
sure.
Super PACs, stuff like that, you know. Corporate financing of your campaign.
Money talks,
but the Torah is like, don't favor the poor, because you have a predisposition to be overly liberal with the poor and to think that, well, you know, he comes from a tough background and I've got to cut him some slack and put yourself in his shoes. The Torah is like, be liberal. Think about the other. As you said before, be conscious of the other's age, experience, situation, the way he sees himself. But at the same time, don't take that too far. Do not pervert justice by overly extending kind of an umbrella, let's put it this way, giving some kind of unfair advantage to the poor.
Well,
to the weak.
What's most important is the context for the statement, right? The end of that verse is "Betzedek tishpot amitecha," right? In righteousness, you should judge your people, because the problem is not being kind to the poor. The Torah is filled with moral statements and legal statements about giving tzedakah and doing acts of kindness. Those things are all encouraged. But when it comes to a situation of judgment, where the primary commitment is to justice, then actually there's a great danger in the desire to be kind. And you know what that danger is? It actually gets expressed a little bit later. There's interesting that word, right, tzedek, which we translate as righteousness, which is often sort of paired with the idea of mishpat, which we translate as justice, is it's hard to define. And in fact, in the world today, I would argue the great disease of the world today is we've lost any tzedek. We know how to judge because that's situational. But the idea of righteousness, later on in our parsha, there will be a string of commandments, which seems very strange. Ma'oz ne tzedek, av ne tzedek, eifat tzedek, v'hin tzedek yelechem. You got to have just weights, just measures. Why does God care about, you know, like when you go to the gas station, there's a little sticker on the gas pump that says the it has been checked that is actually giving you the amount of liquid that it is saying.
Right.
Like, why is that God's business? Shouldn't that just be an issue of governance?
Isn't this Torah portion, on the one hand, be holy unto God, but on the other hand, be a functioning society?
Absolutely. But the particular issue of tzedek is deeper, because tzedek is not the action of justice, of judging. Tzedek is the standard by which you judge. And that's why I believe the Torah puts the emphasis on the poor before the rich. Because everybody understands it's a perversion of justice to favor the rich. But you might think, well, listen, as Rashi says, listen, this guy's poor. He's embarrassed. You know what I'll do? Rashi says, I'll find the poor guy I'll find in favor of the poor guy. The rich guy will pay him out so the poor guy can feel like he's actually been ennobled by receiving money. And then secretly I'll go back and I'll pay the rich guy and I'll tell him, listen, I just wanted to let this person off. But you know what that does to the standard of judgment? Meaning the action may be right, but you undermine the standard. And once you undermine the standard, there's no fixing it.
I remember when I was a kid learning that there was a whole department in the United States government of weights and measures.
Yeah.
That you had to have an official standard, official measures. If you don't have something that everything can be measured by, it all becomes subjective, postmodern, and there's no more truth to hang on.
And listen, I mean, I hate to go from the prosaic to the political, but you look at why the Western world is having such a hard time marshaling itself to fight, you know, ISIS and Islamic fundamentalism, which on the surface of it, you'd say, okay, here's a society that's like chopping people's heads off and throwing homosexuals off of buildings and, you know, et cetera. So that's pretty basic. Obvious, the West is opposed
bad.
To that.
It's bad.
It's bad. It's bad by definition. Bad. But you remember the last president who dared to use the word evil? You know?
George Bush was
the younger, right? The axis of evil, yeah. Right? And he was mocked for that.
Right.
Why was he mocked for it? Because the very word evil implies that there is a standard by which you can say, listen, this yes and that no. And that runs counter to the sort of development of Western society of the last 50 at least, if not 100 years. And here it is, the Torah is telling you, without that tzedek, it's not just you will be unrighteous. You'll have no standard by which to judge. You will actually end up calling up, down, black, white, and good, bad.
And I think you're also saying in there that the technical justice also needs to have a standard of a kind of big picture justice.
Yes.
You could easily pervert it if it's only within the small dictums and the kind of...
if it's purely situational.
Right. Because it's like an accounting...
Yes. Listen, the average situation you can muddle by and say, yeah, this is okay. But the reality is, either when you're faced with trying to mobilize your society, right? Or when you're faced with a nuanced question, like, well, this poor person really needs the bread, right? You ever read, what's the book? Les Miserables.
Saw the play.
Remember how it starts?
No.
What did Jean Valjean go to jail for? Stealing a loaf of bread.
Right.
Here's a 1,000-page book about human suffering and the nobility of spirit. And it all starts with the fact that he stole a loaf of bread because his children were hungry. So everybody would agree, that's terrible. Children shouldn't be hungry, you know, and people should feed them, etc. But there's a very deep tension about the society that is communicated in the book, because the reality is everyone also agrees it's not okay to bust open a store window and steal a loaf of bread. Right? And if you are unable to hold that tension and you say, but listen, it's okay, we have to understand why he did what he did, you may think you're serving that purpose. What you're doing is you're letting society off the hook. Because you're letting society off the hook in determining what is true justice and then having to act on it.
It's funny that Jews are caught specifically in that tension, because, you know, you find that Jews are the culture creators a lot of times, and even the justice creators. There are, four Jewish justices on the
American
United States
Supreme Court.
Supreme Court. So they're in charge of justice, and yet you find that some of the people who head up the issue of moral relativism is actually Jews.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a tough issue. One of the central rabbis of Judaism is Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva's claim is one of the central pillars of Judaism is in this week's Torah portion, and that he mentions this verse. He says, "You shall not be a gossip monger amongst your people. You should not stand aside while your fellow's blood is shed. I am Hashem. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall reprove your fellow and not bear a sin." Not bear a sin because of him. You should not take revenge, as you should not bear a grudge against the members of your people. And here's the phrase that Rabbi Akiva quotes: "You shall love your fellow as yourself. I am Hashem. Vahavta l'recha kamocha. Love your fellow as yourself. I am Hashem." That is the central phrase of Judaism according to Rabbi Akiva, or the most important precept. And it's written in a funny way. It doesn't say love the other. It says love to your friend as you would to yourself. It's a kind of, it's a language that says darsheni, learn me, tease me out. Why does it say it that way? One of the things I want to say is that you got to have a healthy sense of self-love when you approach to love the other. And that's why we have to teach our kids love, and we have to give them love, and we have to give them. There's a talk within these words, is a strong message of giving your kids a good sense of identity, so that they can love themselves. You need to love yourself if you're to love the other. However, let's say you don't love yourself, and there are people who don't love themselves and don't have a healthy sense of self, and have either megalomaniacal or suicidal on the other way, all kinds of extremes of love problems with themselves. So how are they going to love the other? Like Hitler, he doesn't love the other. He doesn't have any empathy for the other. So therefore, God finishes it off with Ani Hashem. That's that what you were talking about. There's a standard, which is even if you don't have a good, healthy internal sense of it, I am God, and I'm going to give you a standard to measure by.
I think there's another element in the way it's written, which is that people learn to love in concentric circles, in circles of intimacy. And like you said, that we generally learn to love within the family unit, right? And if we live in a healthy community, we learn to extend that love, usually at a young age, through school and community. We are both lovers of Shabbat, right? We have your friends over and you have communal mingling. Beyond that, there's love of the nation, right? And further, you can extend that love to all of humanity. And ultimately, this verse ends with Ani Hashem, right? And loving God. And the question is the love of God the ultimate goal, or is it where you begin, right? Is it the outer circle of that concentric circle, or is it the innermost place where you and your intimacy love God? And the answer, of course, is it's both, right? It's both, because there's really only one love. And that's what I find to be the depth here, is that this is a pasuk which invites you to train yourself toward love in order to be able to extend it to everything. Because like our master and teacher Rav Kook says, is that true love is actually boundless, right? One has to train themselves to it, but that if there are elements of creation which one doesn't love, then their love is somehow fragmented and it's not full. He then goes on to say, well, what about evil? And what about our enemies? He says that, that essentially you need to love them insofar as they are a manifestation of creation. And not in their action. And the expression of love, by the way, may be in their destruction, oddly enough.
Right. I think that there's, I'm going to say something which is maybe not very popular, but you have to also love to destroy them. There has to be a place there, and I'll quote a verse, which I quote all the time. Ohave Hashem sin ura. If you love God, you have to hate evil. There's got to be a certain, and I also learned this from Kalev Ben Yefuneh, who said, listen, the enemies of that are in the land of Israel, they're like our bread. We're gonna
eat them up.
And there's even a health to it. There's got to be some kind of, you know, not cruel, but there's got to be some kind of satisfaction in seeing the enemies of God get out of this world. And I know that sounds like very, you know, it's ISIS-y kind of sounding. Well, but when you're not ISIS, and this is the thing, we're not ISIS.
Well, listen, I want to put the pasuk. I don't know if you saw it, but the pasuk that you just quoted, Ohavei Hashem sinu ra, relates directly to ve'ahavta le're'echa kmocha. The resh ayin, that root in Hebrew, is a very strange word. Like, you translated ra as evil or bad. Right, but there is no clarity on what the root of that resh ayin is, because of course two-letter roots don't exist in Hebrew. Most linguists will tell you that is a subset of the word ra'ua. What does ra'ua mean? Do you know?
It's like weak or lacking
because of its brokenness.
Right.
Right, and so therefore, those who love God hate incompletion, hate brokenness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the reality is that when one sees another one as their rea, as their fellow, and they're able to
right,
love them.
So there's the second rea, you haven't said. The resh ayin is also...
Who's also your fellow.
Your fellow, your friend, your buddy,
your companion in some circle of intimacy.
Right.
Because there's a way in which my individuality can be an opportunity for relationship, and that's a cause for love. And there's a way in which my individuality can be a challenge to you. You got to step out of my space, and then I see the world as a fragmented place of I'm me, you're you, it's all discrete. That thinking is dangerous, and it's a love for creation that gets rid of it.
That's exactly what I wanted to say, by the way. I'm not sure how it fits into this verse, but I find that the most important love of them all, and there's four va'ahavtas in the Torah. Twice it says love your God, Vahafta. Once it says love the ger, the sojourner, the other.
Also in this week's parsha.
Right? And the other one is Vahafta Lerecha Kamocha, love your compadre.
Your fellow,
as you would yourself. I think there's a missing, hidden Vahafta. It doesn't say it anywhere, but I feel deeply that it's there just in a hidden fashion, and that is love life. Love life. When you love the gift of life, And you're able to step back and be like, wow, life itself, just being able to be in this body, in this world, is the greatest gift of them all. I find that is one of the greatest clues and secrets into existence.
It is the ultimate moral imperative of the Torah. Uvacharta bechayim. You need to choose life. And in that choosing life, we could look, I don't want to pull us through it now, but there are certain verses in Devarim, when we get there, please God, we'll look at them in their context, that define God as life, not to limit God to life, but meaning that our experience of life is a divine experience, and therefore it is not—it's not something which we love. It is love itself.
Right. God says about himself, "V'ulam chai ani, I am alive.
Yeah.
I am chai, ani od chai." Anyway, speaking of loving life, this show doesn't happen without the help of good people who make it happen. They love life. My friend Jack loves life. He loves his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. He dedicates the show to them. God bless you. And let's bring Moshe, your other friend Jack, into the circle. I can't wait to hear from him. Haven't heard from him in a long time. My good friend's out in Brooklyn, coming out this summer for a big bar mitzvah. I'm very excited about that. So good life is coming. Indeed, you know, good life equals the smell of barbecue. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever noticed that the good life equals? There's some kind of connection between those two. Israelis know that. Israelis know that this season now is the season of barbecues.
Absolutely is.
Especially the holiday of barbecues. And by the way, I had a very deep mystical thought the other day. Can I share it with you?
Please.
Rabbi Mike. And you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer is with me here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov on Spiritual Cafe, our weekly review of the Torah portion. I had a very, I think, a very deep spiritual, you know, sometimes when it comes down to words, that's the most important thing.
Yes.
You know, we sell the whole temple, the whole temple experience is a little bit like, it's a little off. It's like, well, why do you have these animal sacrifices? That's weird. And we're not going to come back to that. There's a lot of dissing of that. And I wanted to say to a person, I've never tried it to anybody. You're the first person that I'm even sharing this with right now on air, just between me and you and everybody else. Imagine if we sold it to people and said, listen, what you see of this world is just one level, one veil. But there's actually a whole mechanism of souls. And souls do not get their completion. They come back reincarnated sometimes as animals. And the temple is a service by which I take part in this redemption of these souls. I sacrifice these animals. I ask for forgiveness for myself. But I'm also releasing a soul of Yankele who didn't make his completion. And the whole thing is part of a mechanism of the releasing releasing of souls into this world or into the next world and helping them get to their completion. And there's this whole spiritual mechanism that we just don't see. It's just not something we see with our eyes. And the temple is part of this thing. It's not just about me, I was bad, here I'm going to kill a goat, and now I feel better. No. There's a whole invisible factory going on here, which gets kind of, you know, which we free up, and we're part, and also this goat actually, you know, this is that goat's opportunity to relinquish that trapped soul inside. Where did I get this idea? I was reading. I was always thinking about what I perceive as sometimes a madness in Judaism with regarding to the knife of the slaughter. Does it have a nick? Does it have a nick? A nicky nick, tiny little nicky nick, nick, nick. It's like we're a little bit extreme about this thing. And I was reading in Rabbi Nachman, and he said, yeah, the Baal Shem Tov explains, this is a release of souls. This is not an operation for you to have kosher meat. That's a side thing. This is a release of souls, and therefore we have to make it super proper and super holy because of there's this whole other
system
that's going on, this whole other factory. And that's really what the temple is about.
Listen, the temple is about many things. I would add to that the idea of the unification of creation through consciousness. That you know, one of the problems of our society is people don't want to accept the fact that we are animals on a certain level. Right, and you see what happens. Like, we push our slaughterhouses away where no one can see them.
Right,
people believe,
and when we do see them, we're like,
yeah. People believe that meat actually comes into being wrapped in plastic in the supermarket. Right. By the way, I've been a vegetarian for 20 years.
Right.
I'm the best barbecuer you know, because my children all eat meat, but I haven't eaten it for 20 years. And one of the things that drives me nuts,
wow,
is that when people speak about animal sacrifice in the temple, and I sometimes wax a little bit passionate about the river of blood that used to flow out of the temple during the Passover sacrifice, which was the sort of largest single shedding of blood that would happen there, and people get grossed out. And I say, wait a minute, do you eat meat? Most people say, well, yeah. I said, so it's okay that there's a river of blood somewhere over there where you don't have to see it as long as you get to eat your meat. But when it's actually in service of unification of creation, of not rejecting but embracing the fact that I'm an animal, and that doesn't mean I'm dirty, coarse, mean. It means I can lift that up through my consciousness and give it to God. Like when we wear tefillin, yeah, I'm going to take the hide of a cow. I'm going to take the hide of a cow. I'm going to write words on it. I'm going to think about those words. I'm going to put them on my forehead. I'm going to point them up. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the entire structure of creation and focus it toward God. Not as some disembodied mind, some spirit that comes from transcendent outside, but as the voice of creation itself that emerges from the very building blocks of the animal world.
And that leads us to the final part of this week's Torah portion. Of course, we just touched it like the tip of the iceberg here. But one of the famous aspects of the Torah portion of Kedoshim is the list of sexual sins, illicit relationships, or relationships that you're not allowed to have, through which, if there is children born, they could be mamzerim, they could be legal Jewish bastards, they're outside of the system. It's a whole business here, and most of them make sense to most of us through morality, right? So you don't want to, you know, you don't want to see people marrying their sisters or their moms, or you don't want to see fathers laying with their daughters. You don't want to see all that kind of stuff, and you understand that now for some reason on a moral intrinsic level, and yet there's also,
by the way, people understand it because it's been drilled into them,
right,
for 3,000 years from this text,
right? Right, because they don't necessarily have to believe this at all. as in the case of homosexuality, which is also measured here, mentioned here. And we live in a society that does not see, on the whole, that as a illicit or improper sexual union. But the Torah portion certainly does, and it also ties in that ties in also to a few other segments in this Torah portion about kilaim, about things that aren't supposed to go together, and those things are certainly not very sensical. It just says don't plant your field with
grapes and wheat.
Right, grapes and wheat, they don't go together. It's like, I didn't know that they don't go together. The Torah says they don't go together. I mean, come on, grapes and wheat, what's the big deal? Torah says
they don't go together,
you know, and so you're either going to accept it, you're going to deny it, or you can accept it and study it, or deny it and study it. But you know, you're going to come to one day, you're going to come to the conclusion that it's the right, that the Torah system is right. Maybe that's not the, you shouldn't use that as a proof in order to fulfill God's commandment. But you know, if you believe that this is really God's word, and you believe that the rest of the stuff is pretty darn smart. But the bottom line is that I want to get back to the system set out for sexual
boundaries,
health, societal health, and basically Rashi says wherever there are sexual boundaries, that's where you find really the recognition of God. God comes out and gets revealed in a place where this has a great word that you use, boundaries, and does not overflow and turn us from animals that are building a society that has flow, that has continuation, that has life, to a society that really destroys itself.
And Rashi says that wherever you find boundaries around sexuality, that's where you find holiness. And I think in that we can see the depth of his definition of holiness. That the ultimate definition of kadosh, and this is Parshat Kedoshim, as we've spoken about before, is devotion. Right? And because when I get married, I'm wholly devoted to my wife, so I'm also separate from other women. So that the boundaries of separation here allow for a proper devotion, especially in the realm of sexuality. And this is one of the very difficult things I find in interacting with my more liberal students and my liberal peers, that understanding homosexuality. Because the Torah's whole aspect on sexuality is that it should be procreative. That even if a particular act of intercourse cannot actually produce a child, the context to channel sexuality is within a relationship whose orientation is toward the procreation of the human species. Because the taking of pleasure in life is not only okay, it's actually, in many people's opinions, the primary purpose of creation, that we should take pleasure in it. But pleasure which is fragmented, which doesn't bring things together and lead to continuity and be involved in commitment and devotion to generations, is ultimately self-serving. And as we saw the difference between Ra'ua, which is this broken world which we're meant to fix, and Rea, which is the union of two people, right? It is the commitment to continuity and myself as part of a larger whole that makes the pleasure I take in life actually holy.
Holy pleasure. And it's a holy pleasure with a WH to spend time with you here at Yeshivat Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov here in beautiful Nachlaot, Jerusalem. You know what? I didn't even mean to say it, but I said it, in that there's no greater pleasure than living as a Jew here in the land of Israel, vacationing here in the land of Israel, getting pleasure from something that is so right. You know, there used to be a song, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the one you love. This is the one you love. The love the one you're with is living in America. But love the one you love, that's here in the land of Israel. And this is one of the most beautiful seasons right now. Also a season of teshuvah, of getting stronger, getting better, getting more connected. We're going to certainly get connected to the story of God's redemption in our time and in our lives through Yom HaTzmaut and Israeli Independence Day and Israeli Yom Yerushalayim, the Jerusalem Day. We'll talk about that on subsequent shows. And thank you so much for being a Rea with me here today, Rabbi Mike Foyer.
Happy to be your fellow.
All right, folks, and write me an email. I want to hear from you, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com. If you love this show, be part of it. And oh yeah, one more tiny thing. I have an incredible offer for you. I have a flag that has been flown over the Mount of Olives. It is tattered. It is tattered, but you can have it. You can have a flag that has been flown over Jerusalem. All I ask is that you help me back. I actually have two of them. And I need a donation of 1,000 shekel, which is what, $250, for the new flag that's going to fly atop of the Mount of Olives. So if you want to help me, if you can donate, the first person to donate $250, and the second person will get the next flag, okay? First person who can donate $250 on YishaiFleischer.com for the flag, that no money will go to anything else but the flag on top of the Mount of Olives, I will send you the old flag. You will have in your possession a beautiful flag that has flown over Jerusalem waiting for Mashiach. All right, folks, we're done with this half. Rabbi Mike, thanks again so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Stay tuned, folks. More great stuff's on the way. And shalom. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting on the Land of Israel Network.com. Welcome to the show. And I'm walking right now, not exactly where you expect me to walk. I'm not sitting in some comfortable studio, but I'm walking with a lot of other Jews. It's nighttime. It's a dark night. I do see some stars above. There's the North Star. And I'm walking in an Arab village. It's 11 and 10 p.m. Excuse me, 11 and 10 minutes p.m. And the deal is that a few times a year, this Arab village called Kifel Charis has another name, Timnat Charis. It's actually in the Talmud. And this village gets closed down by the IDF. Arab traffic is closed down at nighttime, only late at night. And Orthodox Jews, mostly, but all kinds, basically converge on this village. And the reason they converge on this village is in order to visit the tombs of Joshua, the son of Nun, the biblical character, the biblical hero who led the Jewish people, the general, the rabbi who led the Jewish people across the Jordan River, captured Jericho, and finally brought the Jewish people home. We call him Yehoshua bin Nun. And his partner in God's work, and that is Caleb ben Yefuneh, Caleb, the son of Jefuneh. And they are both buried in this, what today is an Arab village. It's in the mountain range of Ephraim, the tribes of Ephraim, Ephraim. And twice or three times a year, the IDF allows Jews, Israelis, to come and visit these two tombs, and also the tomb of Joshua's father, Nun. All three of these tombs are here in Kifel Charis, Timnat Charis, which is right across from the Israeli town, the capital of Samaria, called Ariel. And it's so hard to describe to you what it really looks like as it goes down. First thing, as I said, it's night. It's a dark night. And it's late at night. It's not 7 p.m. It's 11, and this business is going to keep going from 11 to 3 in the morning. Second thing that you'll notice if you were standing walking with me is that there is a smell, not an unpleasant smell, but certainly the smell of Arab villages. It's a smell that I know well from my youth, and it's a smell that is specific to the Arab peoples. And it smells like a village. It smells like a real kfar, as we say in Hebrew. And there are beautiful houses here, as usual. The stories of Arab poverty are simply false. Huge, beautiful houses. Olive trees adorn them. And it looks great. It looks really nice. You would love to live here. You'd be lucky to live here. But you're definitely in a village that's not Jewish. And given the current atmosphere, it means that there is some tension, because there might be some jihadists amongst the people living in this town, potentially. And that's why the army has to secure this town. And so the other part of the scene that I have to describe to you is what it looks like when the Jews, the Israelis, walk through this town. Maybe some foreign media would love to describe it as a night of rampage or something like that. Nothing of the sort is true at all. Quite the opposite. Quite orderly as I'm walking Jews are walking down the streets of this village and are absolutely disinterested in anybody else's property except for getting to the tombs of their fathers here in Kfar Charis. And what's interesting is also the population, the cut of society that is coming out here tonight, the Jews. Mostly, it is Orthodox Jews of the Breslov variety, meaning to say it's Hasidic Jews with sidelocks and all black and funny beaver skin hats. And they are walking through this town. In this dark night, you see these kind of Jews wearing black walking through the town. The next thing that you see is a few religious Zionist types, distinguished by their kippot, their different kippot that they wear, and they wear more, let's say, modern or Western clothes, and a lot of them too have sidelocks, and they are walking amongst the kind of much bigger sea of black hatters, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, the Hasidic Jews, and the other population that you'll find here is the IDF. The IDF, special units of the IDF, snipers, all kinds of vehicles, all kinds of guns are arrayed around this town with their high-tech gear as well. And as we're walking through this town, we feel secure. And if you know some of the political tensions that are happening in this country, you know that the Black Hatters, the ultra-Orthodox, aren't always on the same side, or not the same, let's put it, they're not on the same political stripe as the folks who are serving in the IDF, who are oftentimes, and majority of whom I've seen so far, are secular Jews. And so here is an amazing coming together from the ultra-Orthodox point of view. This IDF is doing exactly right now what it's meant to do, which is to be a holy army and to help the Jewish people get to these places. And right now I got to a square here in the town. This is a square that's dedicated actually to a jihadist who has perpetrated crimes against Israel. And exactly as I got here, I saw that the IDF is parked here with some kind of high-tech gear. And at that very same moment, I turned around and I saw a family with a big, giant flag of Israel on their shoulders, kind of a big, you know, with a pole, and they're walking through the town with a big flag of Israel. Maybe I'll get a chance to catch a picture of them. And actually, I see now that, I was mistaken. The Arabs are in their houses. They don't want to get into any conflict, and they're under curfew. Again, this happens only a few times a year. And had we been living in a time of peace, there would be no need for this. I think Arabs could be making good money, selling drinks and other things. But because of the tension, the army is just simply afraid for the lives of Jews. In fact, not so far away from here today, a car ramming attack took place. And last night in the old city, a stabbing took place. So these claims of a Jewish concern, of Israeli concern over being attacked, are not frivolous by any measure. Again, here I come to an intersection, and I see some very kind of high-tech soldiers walking, protecting us while we're walking through this town. And we're getting closer to my biblical hero, Kalev ben Yefuneh, Caleb, who overcame the plot of the 10 spies who rejected the land of Israel and called for the Jewish people to enter the land of Israel, told them to be fearless. And he went to Hebron in order to pray at the tombs of the fathers and mothers in order to gain strength so that he wouldn't fall prey to the plot of the spies. And indeed, he did not. He had a different spirit, a ruach acheret. And for me to come to the grave of my biblical hero is a coming together of the text of the Bible and the reality of it as it's played out here in the land of Israel. And so we're walking through an Arab village, a pretty one at that, and we're getting close to somebody who is in my, you know, in my consciousness all the time, Kalev Ben Yefuneh. Of course, also my job as the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron makes me connected to this, what I call the alternative forefather of Hebron. And he, of course, God gave him the right to inherit Hebron. And it also became a Levitical city. But Kalev, who overcame fear, did not succumb to the fear of the giants. And now we're coming to a thinner kind of a... it's the road has become narrow here, and so now I'm seeing the real mass of Jews that are walking, and the flag with the family with the flag is taking a picture, and in the light and the street lamp, and we're getting closer, and now I see that there's quite a lot of Jews, and we're the early ones. This is 11, as I told you. This procession is going to keep going all night long, and so. I'm going uphill now. Sorry about the breathing. But the bottom line is that the Jewish people are walking. I wish I could say totally fearlessly. We are relatively fearless, given that we have our IDF, and some of us are armed. But the bottom line is that we're unafraid. My friend, I'm one of us. Are you interested in saying a few words about why we're going to Kalev Ben Yefuneh, Yeshua Ben Nun? You don't have to. Huh? I'm asking, why are we going today to Kalev Ben Yefuneh, Yeshua Ben Nun?
Today is the Yahrzeit.
Of what?
Of Yeshua Ben Nun.
Okay, so that means it's the day of passing of Yeshua Ben Nun. Tell me how you're feeling about walking through this Arab village. The IDF is protecting us, and you're going to a tomb of somebody who's important to you.
We don't need no protection. It's great walking around here.
What do you mean to say that that you believe in the protection of Hashem? What do you mean?
I say we did not need no protection. It's our land.
Very good. Okay. And here we have finally gotten to the tomb of Kalev Ben Yefuneh. And I'm very, very excited to be here. I'm walking through the doors. And through the door, do I walk in? Mako? Okay. He's not letting me enter this area. And I have to go through a different part of the yard here. There I see basically a mausoleum. It's surrounded by a stone wall. It's got two round domes, white domes, and people are here. They're walking through this tiny little gate, the stone gate, ancient kind of stone gate, and they're going into the tomb of Kalev Ben Yefuneh. It's very, very packed inside, and you can hear some of the sounds of the prayers. Again, this is a moment of excitement for a lot of people. A lot of people have not been here in a long time, and so they see this as an opportunity to really let out their prayers. And this is the first kind of stop inside of Timnat Charis, Kifl Charis, at the tomb of Kalev Ben Yefuneh. Let's listen in. Okay, so people are looking at their psalms. They're reading it out loud. There's maybe 150, 200 people in this room right now. It's very hot. The air is not really flowing. And in the middle of this room, where there is a white dome above us, there's a kind of white tomb in the middle of the room. And people are saying psalms. Some of them are crying. Some of them are laying down on top of the tomb themselves, all in order to get a connection with that biblical hero, biblical father, who we've read so much about, who so inspires and informs the Jewish story, the return of the Jewish people here to the land of Israel. And as I look in this room, I see men of different stripes and colors, but basically the same ratio as I described before. Mostly black hatters with sidelocks, and a few religious Zionists as well with sidelocks as well, and a few other kinds. But the bottom line is that there's a vocal, emotional, spiritual sense that the Jewish people are with their own, with their father, and maybe they can get some courage from him as he had courage to overcome the fear that sometimes strikes the Jewish people. All right, so I just came out of the tomb of Kalev ben Yefuneh, and I just wanted you to hear a little bit that the women's prayer is happening here at the same time. I can't go in there, but I can kind of stick in the mic and hope that you hear something. All right, so that is the women's prayer that's happening here at the same time. There's a few vehicles for people who are disabled that are driving around. Mostly, though, people are on foot walking around. I just left the tomb of my biblical hero, Kalev ben Yefuneh. And as I come out, I see right now also two IDF soldiers, very strong, very impressive. Here's another two, and a female soldier as well, protecting us. And securing us, let's use that word, securing us, as we are here at this this incredible site. And you may be asking a biblical question that would make a lot of sense. Why would Caleb be buried here in the mountain of Ephraim, which is in Samaria? If Caleb was the one who fearlessly went to the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs in Hebron, and God gave it to him as an inheritance. And then we have in the 11th chapter of the book of Joshua, the request by Caleb to indeed go to war and capture Hebron. If he loves Hebron so much, if he's so connected to it, what would he be doing being buried here on the mountain of Ephraim? By drive, it's about almost 2 hours away from Hebron, way to the north, different region, different place, not even the same kind of sphere. How does that even make any sense? Why would Caleb, the biblical Caleb, be buried in Hebron, and not in Hebron, but in the Mount of Ephraim, here in Kephel Charis or Timnat Charis, in the mountain of Ephraim? It doesn't seem at first blush to make sense. And that's why some people that I've spoken to over the years have doubted the marking of the tomb of Caleb here in the mountain of Ephraim. And I think that there is a biblical answer. Let me suggest a biblical answer. As I'm walking through this beautiful Arab village, and I'm looking over at the mountains of Samaria that I could see only because of the lights in the distance and the scents, the smells of the Arab village, of the fig tree that I just passed, and the air that's unmistakably Samaria. The answer could be, let me suggest, that Caleb and Joshua were two men who were always together. Together they overcame the plot of the 10 spies who had an evil plot in their mind, who wanted to reject the good land, wanted to reject God's gift. And together, Joshua and Caleb were in the desert for 40 years, seeing their peers die and seeing a whole next generation rise and training that next generation. And indeed, they led the next generation to the land of Israel and fought for it as the leading generals in the battle. So these two men overcame their peers, saw a whole generation die, led the nation back into the land of Israel. Of course, I forgot to mention, of course, they were part of the Exodus, received the Torah at Sinai. They did everything together. And so when the time came to be buried, I think that it was Caleb who said, "Though my inheritance is Hebron, let me be buried next to my rabbi, next to my general, next to my mentor, next to my inspiration, and the greatest man of that generation, which was Joshua, the son of Nun, Yoshua ben Nun." And in fact, now we've gotten to kind of the main show here. We are in one of the main squares of this Arab village, and there's some Arab cars parked here. There's a mosque with its distinguishing markings, which are the minaret and the green kind of fluorescent lights. And instead of Arabs walking around here right now, it's all Jews and Israelis. The IDF, a lot of men without skull caps at all, brandishing modern M16s, modern versions of and Israeli guns. And they're not doing it menacingly. They're doing it in a security fashion. And then all kinds of, all manners of Orthodox Jews and other kinds, a lot of Sephardic Jews, people who connect to visiting the tombs of the righteous. And we have arrived at one of these main squares in town, and lo and behold, in this main square of this Arab village is also the burial place of Joshua. Joshua! We're talking about the moon to Moses' son. We're talking about one of the greatest men that lived in all times, and his tomb is right here. I'm standing before it, and there's many, many people lighting candles, praying. There's also a truck, and that truck is delivering drink to anybody who needs it, sweet drink to give people a little bit of energy, give them the strength to go on, because we're walking. A big light has just been turned on in the middle of the square, kind of a generated light that has been brought, and there's men and women here, and what can I tell you? We've come to Joshua. Joshua, who brought the Jewish people across the Jordan and into the land of Israel, and he's buried today in the heart of what has become an Arab village, but across from a very big Jewish city called Ariel. So that's where I am right now. That's where I find myself, and I wish you that you were here with me. Let me see what else, what kind of sound I could bring to you from the tomb of Joshua, who encircled Jericho seven times on that seventh day, blew the trumpets, the shofarot, the ram's horn, and brought the walls down. So I'm here with Rabbi Meir Vaknin, who walked over to me. And Rabbi Meir Vaknin, tell me what we're doing here at the tomb of Joshua, the son of Nun.
Yes. His only people, he come here because he's a very big tzaddik. He named Rabbi Yeshua ben Nun. He's very love. He's Moshe Rabbeinu. He's Shamesh. Anytime he pray for me, love Israel, he give only people from... only people is God. He speak to... In Yeshua ben Nun, please take to only people and go and pray anytime from every people he come to Israel, because Israel is very special from only Jewish, because Eretz Israel is very, very, very beautiful and special. Now, Yeshua ben Nun, he give pray in Aleinu Leshabeach, is
the end of the prayers, the Aleinu Leshabeach, the final prayers.
Yes. Is the special tefillah, because it's Moshe Rabbeinu. He say, if I'm not going to Israel, please, Yeshua ben Nun, go you. Take to every people, love him, and give emunah, and give simcha, and give anytime. Is you look eyes from every world who is God. Thank you from every people. And God bless him. He give him. Is Yeshua ben Nun. He want. He pray his day in Ilula. Is many people come here because every people he want look is Meshamesh in Moshe Rabbeinu.
Rabbi, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. And indeed, that is the reason why we're here today, because today is the day of passing in the Jewish tradition of Yehoshua ben Nun. That's why we are here today. That's the actual reason that the army decided tonight. It's not just an arbitrary decision. It's actually a specific decision because of the significance of the date. And as I'm standing here, more and more people are piling in. As I told you, I came in really in the first wave, and now... Now people are really coming in, and you know, the funny thing is the atmosphere is totally congenial. There's this absolute feeling of normalcy, of love, of kind of it's actually safe and happy, and there's no war. Yes, there's an IDF, but it's all kind of, I don't know, how can I say it? I think that we melt a little bit when we come to places like the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron and the Tomb of Joshua here and the Tomb of Caleb. We kind of become... as we really are, the children of Israel, and we come together as children who play nice with one another, and who are sometimes the adversity that we face here brings out a certain beauty, because tonight it's not just any time that we could get here. It's a joy. It's a pleasure to be able to be given this opportunity, and we know that it doesn't come all the time, and so therefore there's a kind of a thankfulness and a camaraderie, because we know that we are surrounded by enemies, and to come home to our fathers and not be afraid, it's a tremendous schut, a tremendous merit. All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my visit to the tombs of Caleb, Joshua, and Joshua's father, Nun, next to Ariel. It was an amazing trip, an amazing night trip into this village, and as I'm recording this right now, I'm looking over at the Temple Mount. And right in front of the Temple Mount is my flag, the flag of Israel, which is flying so very proudly today on Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day, Holocaust Remembrance Day. I'm looking at the Temple Mount. I'm remembering the 6 million who died for being Jewish, but they did not die for nothing. They died because in their death, soon after, was the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, a dream of generations that has come true. It is God's dream, and He is bringing it to fruition. Thank you, God, for letting us even have a smidgen of a role, of a part to play in this great, incredible story of yours, your great dream. And God, let us have strength, continued strength to do it. Folks, I want to hear from you. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com. You can connect to me on Twitter. You can connect to me on Facebook, certainly, on YouTube, on LinkedIn, and all these different ways. Please check out where I work, which is, again, a great privilege. I'm looking at the Temple Mount, but I work next to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs in Hebron. Check out our website, hebron.com, and please help us stay strong out there. That Jewish community is fighting for its existence, fighting to grow, fighting to push back the jihad, and fighting to teach the world about the heritage of the fathers and the mothers. So please be part of that story as well. The story of Israel, the story of the fathers and mothers who loved God and He loved them back. So thank you so much for being with me. Stay connected, stay strong. Thank you to Ari and Jeremy and thelandofisrael.com. Thanks to Ben Bresky, Tabitha, Moshe, who make the show happen through their amazing productive production skills. And we should continue to produce and reproduce, be reborn, born and reborn in this great land, in this great story. Stay strong, stay connected, stay tuned, and shalom.